Vaccines are a trending topic for many valid reasons at this moment, so we wanted to invite on Dr. Joel Gator-Warsh to talk with us today about his perspectives and experiences as an integrative medicine pediatrician in LA and author to his new book called Between a Shot and a Hard Place. Dr. Gator and I discuss the factors leading to overall declining vaccination rates and what's contributing to parental vaccine hesitancy. We also talk about the types of safety and long-term data collection studies that he would like to see and the current difficulty of talking about nuance and individuality in today's medical culture. We talk about alternative schedules, vitamin K, and more. It's jam-packed, so let's dive in.
Welcome to Healthy as a Mother, the podcast for becoming and being a mother, with your co-hosts, Dr. Leah Gordon and Dr. Morgan McDermott, two naturopathic doctors who get it.
Each week, we teach you how to be the healthiest mother you can be, from fertility and preconception to pregnancy and birth prep, through postpartum and throughout motherhood, empowering you with the natural health guidance and education you're not getting elsewhere, so you can confidently navigate the broken system at large.
The real, the raw, the untalked about. And remember, this information is not intended to diagnose, treat, or manage any disease. Always consult with your doctor before making any changes.
True hydration comes from a mix of water and minerals, not water alone. And while we love to discuss the benefits of Redmond Relight powders for you parents in the fertility, pregnancy, and postpartum times of your life, let's not forget about the kids. Redmond has launched their Relight Kids line of electrolyte powders, specifically with kids in mind. The mineral amounts and proportions are lessened to be more appropriate for children or for adults who want or need less sodium intake. They come in three fantastic flavors that my children love: pineapple, pink lemonade, and grape, and contain all the benefits of Redmond's honorable manufacturing and quality control practices. They contain the 60 plus trace minerals in just the salt portion alone, and we know how much metabolic support childhood demands, so support your kiddo in their sports and play recovery, growth, energy production, and more with Relight for Kids. You can use code HEALTHYMOTHER for 15% off at redmond.life. And use the code to also enjoy the other Redmond products like their natural toothpastes, seasoning salts, bentonite clays for baths, and more. Again, head to redmond.life and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 15%. Okay, welcome to the podcast, Dr. Joel Warsh, aka Dr. Joel Gator. So tell us, how are you having these two different last names?
So my wife's last name is Intelligator, and people thought it was funny and started calling me Dr. Gator, and then it kind of stuck. So since I'm in pediatrics, either the kids like it, so I've kept it going.
I love that. That is awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here. It's an honor. For the listeners that don't know who you are, I'm going to read your bio so that they do, and then we are going to start talking all about vaccines and from the childhood perspective, but you know, maybe we'll get into other forms of vaccination, but I think we'll probably stick to kids in this one. So Dr. Joel Warsh, aka Dr. Joel Gator of the Popular Parenting Instagram account, is a board certified pediatrician in Los Angeles, California, who specializes in parenting, vaccines, wellness, and integrative medicine. He's the author of a new book that is called Between a Shot and a Hard Place, Tackling Vaccine Questions with Balanced Data and Clarity, which I love that name. And it comes out on May 20th. So everybody can go and pre-order it now. But it won't be available for a little bit yet, but it's very highly anticipated. He grew up in Toronto, Canada, and completed a master's degree of epidemiology before earning his medical degree from Thomas Jefferson Medical College. He completed his pediatric medicine training at the Children's Hospital of Los Angeles, and then worked in private practice in Beverly Hills before founding his current practice in Studio City. Dr. Gator has published research in peer-reviewed journals on topics including childhood injuries, obesity, and physical activity. He's been featured in numerous documentaries, films, summits, podcasts, and articles. So thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me on. I'm excited to chat.
Yeah. So in this new book, you know, Between a Shot and a Hard Place, that's, I think, exactly how it feels for parents is like, you know, you're between this rock and a hard spot. Like, what do you do? And there's so much information now out there. There's so many opinions that feel very extreme and very scary on either end. You know, you do this and you're going to kill your child. You don't do this and you're going to kill your child or other children. And it's just, there's such an extreme. And right before we started recording, I shared my opinion with you, and you know, you were nodding along, because I think that we both, people who are in this sort of field where you do anything with pediatrics whatsoever, and if you're in any kind of integrative medical sphere, you see that there's actually the portion of the population that's the largest is those that are neither identifying with either of the extremes. They're neither wholehearted 100% pro-vax, and they're neither, or I mean, sorry, 100% wholehearted anti-vax. It's this middle ground where they're like, well, I mean, maybe some, maybe not all, maybe a little bit later, delayed, spread out. There's obviously some issues. There's obviously some kind of shadiness with the industry that is questionable. And I wish that we could just talk about those factors that are making parents second guess what is going on with this entire thing and why it is my, you know, gut and intuition not trust these people, because there is a lot of reasons not to, you know? And so I think that those, that number of people is far greater than we are even recognizing. And it's silly and not helpful to anybody to just not talk about it. So obviously I know that that's your whole MO and you wrote an entire book about it, but so let's start talking about that. What do you think contributes to this vaccine hesitancy or like this questioning that this group lies in?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, I would say I agree with everything that you just said. I mean, the reason why I wrote the book in the first place was because of all of that. It's because I think parents are just so frustrated. It's been the topic that I would never talk about. Like for years, you know, I did lots of podcasts and lots of shows, but I would go on and say like, you know, I'll talk about anything but vaccines because it's just so controversial. Everybody gets so mad. And I think that people are more interested to talk about it now. I think we're in a little bit different place, but we have to talk about it. There can't be any subject that we make it so controversial that we can't even have a discussion about it. We have to talk about the pros and the cons. Everything is not black and white. It's gray. I think most people, like you said, are in the middle somewhere. That's how it seems to be in my office. I mean, there are some people that go on the regular schedule, some people that go or don't want to do any vaccines. Most are somewhere in the middle and want to do a slow schedule or something along those lines. But it's not crazy to have concerns. I mean, you should have concerns about everything when it comes to your kids. You should have questions. We should talk about these things. And we have to have open, honest discussions if we want to move forward with this. And that is why I think that there is such a hesitancy around vaccines right now, because I think that people don't feel like they get to talk about it. It's like more taboo than heroin or something. Like it's more taboo than drugs at this point. You can't even talk about it. And that makes people nervous. Like why is this being censored? Why can't we talk about it? And especially with COVID, we lived through a new vaccine. We lived through changing communication. We lived through seeing what was said, seeing things that didn't end up being true, seeing things that made no sense. And that made a lot of parents question everything. And now we have more information. I think there's a lot less censorship, even just in the last couple of months online. And so there is more discussion around this topic. And so we're just seeing the respect in medicine and the trust in medicine plummet to like the lowest it's ever been. It was 70% on huge studies in 2020, before 2020. And now it's like 40%. The hesitancy rates are the highest they've ever been. You look at the kindergarten rates the last couple of years, it keeps going up, you know, 3-4% of kindergartners are a couple percent are not getting vaccines. That's the highest exemption rates we've ever seen. So we are seeing this trend in hesitancy that we've never had before. And the very thing that medicine is trying to stop in terms of vaccine hesitancy is the very thing they're actually creating by not talking about it. And I've never had more patients come to the office and be like, I don't trust anything in medicine. I don't want to do anything, you know, and that's why people come to my office. That's why people reach out to me. That's the questions I get online. They just want to talk about it. And I think that they don't feel like the information exists. And it doesn't really exist in any accessible way. It's really difficult to find anything that's not extreme. Like you go to something on the CDC site and everything's perfect and it's like the best thing ever and there's never a problem. And then you go look at some other books and they're the worst thing ever and you should never do it. And there's not a lot in between. And, you know, at this point I was like, I have to do this. I have to put this together. The book doesn't tell you what to do. I don't think we should be telling people what to do. I think providing people information and opening up this discussion. And this is for sure, because I've read pretty much all the vaccine books at this point over the last year just to get ready for this book. And, you know, they all have a side. They all cherry pick data. And that's not helpful to most parents, I think, who really want all the information and they want to see something that RFK thinks right beside what Paul Offit thinks. And we don't really have that right now.
Yeah, I love that. And the thing that's so crazy about right now in this modern day and age is that if you have any belief, basically, you can go and find something that backs that up from any angle. And it's so difficult to sort through. And also one same, you know, just an event can take place or a paper can be written and the amount of interpretations that can come from that one thing, it's mind-boggling to me. And I feel like one thing that I just naturally am good at, that it's a trait that I've had to learn to embrace because sometimes it leads to indecision and whatever, but I often feel that I'm very good at looking at things from both sides and understanding where people would come to that conclusion and being like, I get that. I understand that if this is what you're seeing and this is what you're reading, this is what you're going to think, and how that feeds into people's biases or whatever. But then now there's also all of this like very, very, very loaded, heavy political attachment to a medical issue and a medical procedure or intervention, I guess, not a procedure, but an intervention that children are getting. And it's, people have so much fear around it in general. They have fear whether they do it, they have fear whether they don't. They just feel damned both ways. And yeah, you can't even talk about it. You can't talk about it with your friends. There's going to be friends of yours that are just like, they think that people are idiots for doing it. They think people are idiots for not doing it. They think that. And it's such a sad thing to watch take place. I mean, there's many levels of division that are happening in our world right now, but this one particularly, because it revolves around children who have they don't know that we're all having these conversations, you know, these adults, and that we are just like absolutely driven insane by these, this like lack of information that we want to know. I think it would be really different if the leaders during COVID could have said, hey, we're working on this vaccine. It's going to be the best that we can have. And right now we think that the stats are this. And then 6 months later, it's like, oh, update. Actually, we thought it was going to work like this, and it's kind of working like this. Now, it would still probably be a good idea for these populations to get it. Oh, these other populations don't seem to be affected. Nobody's died in these types of ages or whatever. But there's none of that. It's take it or die. It's take
right,
it.
Right, right. And I was just like I literally basically say that. I said in the book, I said it many times. Like, I think that is where medicine lost respect of the population, because something was said, safe and effective was said over and over and over again, and it is propaganda. It's not a realistic statement. Like, it's not the thing that you're supposed to be saying. It's not true, right? What you should be saying is, based on the information that we have, the benefits seem to outweigh the risks. We recommend this due to the blah, blah, blah reasons. That's it. That's all you can say, because yes, you don't know in 10 years what the safety profile is on something new, and you can't. Like, nobody expects you to know what happens in 10 years when something's new. You can't say that you're not going to grow a third arm or get cancer 5 years from now from this thing. Like, we don't know that. We just know, here is the research. Here's what we did. Here's what we're seeing. It seems to be helping out these people and decreasing risk of going to the hospital. We don't know if that's going to be true in 3 months or 6 months, but that's what we know. So we're recommending it. As soon as you start moving over into this propaganda world and everybody should do it no matter what, and take it or you're going to lose your job, and we know everything, then people saw all of that and they were like, this can't be true. This doesn't make any sense. Why are you telling me this? And now I don't trust anything that you're saying. And that is just so sad, because it didn't have to be that way. And we know now for sure. I mean, Mark Zuckerberg has said it. They were trying to silence true information just because they didn't want to create hesitancy. As soon as you start doing that, you lose trust, because there is no trust, because you're lying. You're just saying like, well, this might make some people nervous, so we're not going to put that information out there. If there are side effects, people deserve to know. That's informed consent. And they deserve to know the best information so they can make a decision. And just because there's a potential side effect or something doesn't mean we're not going to do it. Like, people take cancer drugs and it makes your hair fall out and destroys your immune system, but you do it because you might survive the cancer, right? Like, we know the risks and the benefits, and you have to weigh those things. So just because there is a risk doesn't mean that people aren't going to do it. But if we're not honest with those risks, then we're going to continue to see this slide of trust. And we are getting to the point where just more and more people are not doing it. 5% of people kids are getting exemptions now in many, many locations. So it's a pretty huge swing backwards. And even you look at some of the studies, like 10% of doctors don't have full faith in vaccines anymore. That you look at like how many people are saying that they feel like vaccines are super important. It's dropping like a lot. And so none of what they're doing is working.
Exactly. Like you said, it's the exact opposite of what the goal and the intention was. I think we would all, as people have way more respect for an agency that just could come out and say, this is what we know right now. And when things change, we'll let you know. And maybe the numbers would have been greater too, because it would have been like, well, you know, putting, you can't make people do anything. And, or I mean, I guess in a free world, in a free society, you can't. And I think that more than ever had no choice, like, you know, being fired from their jobs, et cetera, whatever. So all of this has on the tails already of, I think, growing vaccine hesitancy over the course of the last like 10 years, but COVID for sure pushed it. And so it's curious because I don't know how they're going to, unless somebody is able to really step in and say, look, we've got some problems and we want to change them. That would be so cool. The idea of vaccination is so cool and it's so brilliant. And it's like, guys, surely we can do so many amazing things. Surely we can do it better. If there are problems, I think that there's a situation where they've dug their heels in saying safe and effective so many times that they almost just can't even admit that there's a problem. And it's like, well, listen, we know it already. So why don't you just come out and say it and then we'll all move forward and try some different things. Like the fact that, I mean, yes, there's like this new RSV vaccine and the mRNA vaccines are coming out, whatever. But the fact that like prior to that, there has been very little innovation and change to any of these on the schedule, any different combinations or maybe singular ones. And it's just like, guys, I don't know. I think that people don't question it. They don't want to question it. They don't want to think about it. And it's also exhausting. And as a doctor, I'm sure that many of your colleagues who are getting information, you know, from their medical schools and even from the pharmaceutical reps that are then educating them about the different new vaccines that are coming out, they know that they're going to have to go and do more of their own research on it. And it's just like, holy moly, when am I going to have time for that? You know, there's so much responsibility put on the shoulders to like actually really get it and understand it, because we know that what we're hearing is just like a sales pitch. And that's not a conspiracy theory.
But I don't think that most doctors recognize that. Because I didn't. I think that's a big problem. I don't think that we realize how entrenched pharma is in everything and how deliberately they have shaped the narrative over the last 100 years or 50 years or however far you want to go back. And so we just don't recognize that they fund the schools, they fund the journals, they fund the studies, they fund everything purposely. They fund the politicians, they do all of that, they fund our news. And so we just get one narrative and we don't even realize that we're kind of being marketed to at all times. And I make the joke in the book, it's like there's no medical class, why not to trust pharma 101, right? It's like we don't think about it. You just trained as a pediatrician, like, okay, here are the vaccines, here's the schedule, this is what's been studied, this has been proven to be safe, here are the diseases, here are what the diseases can cause. You don't really have discussions on safety of vaccines or improving vaccines. Like, that's just not part of the discussion. It's not something I ever really thought about, but it has become so much more of an issue, especially as an integrative practitioner, that I got just more involved and I shied away from talking about it for a long time. But I feel like now is the time to do that. And I'm not against vaccines. Just like you said, like they're magical. Like, it's a magical thing, a perfectly working vaccine. If you could, you know, give your kid a pill or something and they would never get sick again, that's great. But that's not the reality of the world. Everything has risks and benefits and we have to weigh those. And it does seem like in the last 20 years or so, we have moved away from the fact that there could even be a risk from a vaccine. It's like they're perfect for everything and they have nothing to do with chronic disease and they have nothing to do with long-term risks and they can't affect your immune system and they're perfect. And that's just been the general mentality, I think, for a while. And that doesn't lead to making them better, doesn't lead to any sort of oversight. There's really no oversight on these pharmaceutical companies for the most part. I mean, there are little things here and there, but they get it on the schedule and everybody says it's perfect. And then you just do it. And we have precedent to take vaccines off the market and make them better. And we've done it with the DTP. We have the DTaP. They did it with rotavirus. There was an interception and they made a better version of it. So it's not like it can't happen. It's not like we can't make them better. And, you know, first of all, I mean, doctors are there to help kids. Like, they're not trying to harm them. So I know that if something was identified that was harming kids, that they would want it to be better. So I don't think it's that. I just think that we don't think about these things. And if some ingredient in the vaccine was triggering asthma, let's just say, then wouldn't we want to know that so that way we could maybe take that out or change it or decrease or change up the schedule so we could decrease that risk of asthma for kids? Like, if we think about it in that way, we could study the schedule in multiple different ways to see if there are ways to make improvements. But we don't really do that. It's just like, oh, we've got this vaccine. Oh, it's been studied by the company. It's great. All right, we shove it on the schedule whenever we decide that we're going to do it. And then that's it. Like, that's the end of the studying. And it's like a mix and match. Everything's the same. There's no problems. You can do whatever company's vaccine you want. You can do it in any sort of general order like this. It doesn't make any difference. And I'm sure that's not true. I'm sure there are ways to make it safer.
Yeah. So let's talk about that. What, like, about the testing? So there are some safety studies, like you said, but what are the limitations of those? What is it that's lacking from those studies that the community really is wanting that there sort of isn't out there? If you had your ideal, what would it be that you would see out there?
Yeah, the wording on this is very important and specific, because you do hear out there people say things like these haven't been safety tested and they're not placebo tested. And it's not true. There's a ton of testing for any vaccine that comes out at any point in time, and there's certainly lots of testing after. What is not done is inert placebo-controlled trial testing. So inert placebo meaning against something that's like salt water, saline, like not an active compound. The vast majority of the research on all the vaccines from today that are on the market that kids get were never really studied against an inert placebo. They were mostly studied against another version of that same vaccine. So if you have the newer version, they'll study it against the older version. They'll study it against a different vaccine. They'll study it against the vaccine without the actual antigen in it. So they might study like the rotavirus vaccine, but they study it without the rotavirus part in there, everything else. So they're not studying it in the most optimal way in terms of looking for safety. And they make safety claims, but realistically, you can only, if you're comparing against two things, like let's say a new MMR versus an old MMR, the safety claim is technically between those two. It's like it's not more dangerous or less dangerous than the other one. But if both of them have you grow a third arm, then you know, then you wouldn't. If each group, five people grow a third arm, oh, it's the same safety, right? That like they can say that with those kind of testing versus against a placebo where nobody grows a third arm, and you can say, well, five people grow a third arm, that's not good. So we don't have that testing for most of these vaccines, and that is one of the big things that people are concerned about when they talk about not having optimal safety. The second thing being long-term testing. So most vaccines are studied fairly short-term, some of them just a few days, some of them a couple months, very rarely more than a year before they get licensed. Because, you know, if you're studying something for 10, 20 years, then you're never going to get any products on the market. So there is a balance there, but we are lacking long-term safety. And I think by and large right now, the biggest concern in the, I don't know if you want to call it anti-vax movement or the against, you know, people that are more hesitant are concerns about what it's doing to your immune system, what it's doing to you long-term, whether it's contributing to chronic diseases. That is a big concern. And you don't really capture that with the vaccine studies as you have them now, because if something doesn't develop for a while, then it's really hard to, well, you wouldn't catch it in a study that's going on for a couple months. You wouldn't catch cancer 10 years down the road because it hasn't been studied. So the only way that you would figure that out is if somebody says, hey, I think people getting MMR are getting cancer 10 years from now. Let me study that. And that's really hard to do that unless you're doing a prospective study for many years. And we don't have that, and nobody's doing that. And you could do it. And that's what I think we do need to do. But we don't have those studies, and nobody's looking at those kind of things.
And then what about all of them in the schedule that we have now too, you know, multiple in one day?
Right. So they're not studied in that way. I mean, sometimes when you're doing a study, they'll do some of the other vaccines just on the side, but they're studying the individual vaccines because most vaccines are being studied by the company that's making them. So most of the research is done by the company, and they're obviously biased. And so they're setting up the trials in obviously the best way to get them to succeed, but that doesn't mean they're doing anything nefarious, but you know, I mean, if you're making a product, then one would assume it's a little biased. And they're not studying the schedule. They're studying their vaccine. So we don't have trials on the whole schedule. What's safe? What's safer? What's not safe? How many? We're adding new vaccines every year. And it's just like just kind of throwing them into the schedule based on the consensus. But you're not studying that and how that affects. You're just assuming that it won't have some sort of effect. But maybe getting four vaccines on a day does something to your body versus just the one. And we don't really know that.
And that's, I think a lot of parents assume that there's the entire CDC schedule, you know, studied as a group unit, and that, yeah, every time they're going to add something, that they've done their due diligence and made sure that that doesn't have any interactions and there isn't an increased risk. There isn't a tipping point now where something is happening with the immune system that wasn't happening prior with a given other set of vaccines, and it's just not happening. And then another study that I know a lot of people would like to see that it doesn't seem there is, but I want to ask you about this, is populations of vaccinated children versus unvaccinated children.
Right. So that would be the ideal. I mean, that's what we're missing if we did the proper study. I mean, if we really wanted to know things, we would study things prospectively, vaccinated versus unvaccinated. It is a little bit difficult to do the most optimal studies now because you run into ethical issues, which is unfortunate because it wasn't done originally, should have been done originally, because you can study. Well, the reason why it's a problem, I guess we start there, is ethically speaking, you have a product which theoretically works very well and protects you from a disease, right? That's the premise of vaccines. And so if you were to study children unvaccinated, then you're not giving them the vaccines, and that would be unethical. Or you might have people that don't want to get vaccines and you're giving them a vaccine, so that's also unethical because they don't want it. So that makes those studies really difficult to do. You could do it, but it's probably never going to happen, or not in the near future, because the ethics would be really difficult to do. So we should have had these done when the products were first made. And that's the thing, right? They didn't do it when they're first made. When you have a new product, like the first pneumococcus, first Prevnar, you could study that against an inert placebo because there isn't any other thing that you're comparing it to. There isn't anything on their market. So you're not preventing that kid from getting any sort of vaccine. How did they study it against meningococcus, right? They studied against another vaccine. They know what they're doing. They're trying to rig the deck a little bit so that there could be some side effects potentially. That's the only thing I can think of. I don't know why else you wouldn't just study it against water. It's more expensive to use another vaccine, but that's how they do their trials. So now we're in this predicament because we have all these things on the market and we don't have those studies and they were never done. And people want them, but it's unlikely to happen. So there are ways to do it. It's just not ideal. You can get volunteers, or you can get people to volunteer and say that they don't want to vaccinate, they're not going to vaccinate, and you can study them prospectively against people that do. There are limitations with that kind of research, but it's still pretty good. You're still going to get good information. And I think that would make a lot of people happy to see and start following over the years. And that is one of my big suggestions at the end of the book, is that we should start a big trial right now. And that'll give us a lot of information in 10 years. We did it with heart disease. We did it, the Framingham study, and they're still going. It's like, I don't know, 60 years later, whatever it's been since, like, I don't even know when they started, but it's been going for a long time, multi-generation, and we can do it. We can enroll people that say they don't want to vaccinate. If they choose to change their mind, they want to vaccinate, so be it. But you can follow people forward and you can watch and see, and you can see how much autism develops and how much chronic disease develops and all these things. And you won't be able to specifically point to the vaccines only, because it's very easy to say, well, you know, it's the lifestyle, they live differently, these people are more holistic minded, but that's still super relevant, interesting information, because
yes,
you can still say, like, hey, the risk of asthma in the unvaccinated lifestyle is much lower, you know, if that's true. That's good to know. Or it might be the same and you're gonna be like, well, these people say they're all living more healthy and they're not getting any vaccines and they have the exact same asthma rates. So that would be very helpful to know. And I think that could be done and should be done.
And now a moment from our sponsor. If you are looking for a delicious and effective immune supplement that your entire family can use, from children through adults and even while pregnant and breastfeeding, look no further than the needed immune support powder. With elderberry, zinc, pre and probiotics, beta-glucans, and arabinogalactans, the needed immune support powder is a very tasty berry treat that you can easily mix into water, yogurt, popsicle recipes, smoothies, gummies, and more. It's something that I always have on hand and give at the first sign of illness to any of my children as well as myself. Give it a try by visiting thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20% off your first order. Again, visit thisisneeded.com and use code HEALTHYMOTHER to save 20%. Yeah, I agree. I feel like hopefully now there will come a tipping point where hopefully the organizations will listen to the majority of the people that are interested, and also for the public health stance of things, that if their numbers are dwindling so much, they're going to have to pay attention to what it is that people are wanting. And yeah, it might take 10 years, like you said, to follow them, but it's like, why not though? If nothing comes from it, then whatever. But if it's a volunteer situation, you're not forcing anybody into an unethical situation, like you mentioned, having something that could potentially save their life versus having, you know, maybe giving them something that causes some sort of an permanent injury of some kind. So I think that I'm hopeful, at least, that hopefully things will change like that. So I wanted to ask you about delayed schedules. So as a parent, what's the best way to go about making delayed schedules? Or what do you think of delayed schedules? What are the things that factors that people need to be thinking about? Are they as effective? Obviously you're missing the risk of those little babies with certain illnesses. And, you know, how do you kind of, living in California is tricky now because of your lack of exemptions that you have and requirements for school. Up until 2015 or whenever that was, it was not that way, right? Or 17, I forget what year it happened, but can we talk more about delayed schedules too?
Yeah, with delayed schedules, first of all, I think it's important to say the only thing that's ever been studied is the CDC schedule. Like, that's what's recommended. That's what's been studied. Theoretically, that's what's recommended. That is the only thing that a doctor can recommend because that's the standard of care. Anything else outside of that is really personal choice. And there isn't research to say, well, if you do it at this way, it's going to be most optimal. Or if you do this one a little bit later, that's not most optimal. Like, when I talk to parents about it, it's really weighing the pros and the cons for yourself, what risks you're willing to take, and then creating a schedule that you're comfortable with. Because there isn't anything to really point you to one way versus another. So you just kind of make it up as you go. And that's usually what we do. I mean, there are different kinds of slow schedules, from you want to do not as many on one day to you want to start later. So some people say, well, I don't really feel comfortable doing any vaccines till 6 months or a year. I don't want to do anything till then. So then you just start going through it from there. Other people just don't want to do 3 or 4 vaccines on one day. So they decide they just want to do one and they just work their way through. The big downside to going on a slow schedule would be that if you happen to have the child who gets whatever disease before you get the vaccine, because you delayed that vaccine, then you're at risk, you know, more from that disease. And you potentially just be very unlucky. Most of these diseases have a very low risk right now, but just not zero. So you could be the one kid to get whatever disease, and that vaccine could have helped you for that. Other than that, if you decide to do a slow schedule, you're still getting all the vaccines in general. You're just spacing it out over more visits. So it might mean you have to come in a little bit more, a few more pokes, that kind of thing. And that's up to the, you know, up to you if you're okay with that. But other than that, there's not really a big risk from doing that. It's just more, you know, annoying to have to come in so many times to get all the vaccines, but you're still getting them, and you're getting most of them fairly close to when you would be getting them otherwise. So those are the big two ways that people do it. I have on my site and on the book, I put some things that I've seen, but everybody's different. There's a million ways to do it, because you could do combo shots. You don't do combo shots. You want to do one every month. You want to do one every 2 months. You want to come in every couple of weeks. Like, there are many different ways to do it based on your comfort level. So usually what I have found that people do and what makes the most sense is to, again, weigh risks versus benefits. So what are the things that are most likely to get? What are the things that most likely could kill you if it happens to be that you get very unlucky? And then you kind of work through there, because, for example, in 2 months, you might be getting the polio vaccine, right? That's recommended. But do you have a real risk of getting polio? Not really when you're 2 months. I mean, it's possible, but nobody's got polio in a very long time. So people tend to push that one back. You know, hepatitis B, if your parents don't have it, then you have a chance to get hepatitis B. Very, very, very low risk. So people tend to push that back. You have a risk to get whooping cough. You have a risk to get hemophilus. You have a risk to get pneumococcus. So these are things that more parents tend to do on the earlier end, because you're like, okay, what can I actually get? What could actually kill my kid? Theoretically, again, low risk. Most times you get these things, it's not that big a deal, but it's just possible that you could die from these things. You could get meningitis, you could get pneumonia, could get very sick and go to the hospital. So that, to me, makes sense if you're weighing things or going slow. Just push the things forward that you have the most risk to get, and then push the things back that have a lower risk, and still not zero, right? You still could push back hepatitis B, and somebody could bleed on you that has hepatitis B. So it's possible, just not as likely. So if you're choosing which ones to do, that's how usually parents choose, I think.
Yeah, I love that you are focusing on the ones that are the most risky at that age. I feel like that's the way that it should be for every child, right? That, in my opinion, it's like, why would we not take every kid and say, these are the actual ones that can cause a lot of problems for you and for you and your family as this child? Because different risk factors will come into play. Like, are they going to daycare? Do they have older siblings? Are they not? Are they nannied at home and, you know, you're not going anywhere? And there's, then let's now talk about those different risks. And you don't maybe want to do it right now. But I think things like, yeah, polio at 2 months or hepatitis B at birth also contribute to the vaccine hesitancy, because people are like, what? Why? What is going on? And it's just the, we have to remind people that this is a public health initiative and it's not an individual medicine initiative. And we've come to realize, I think we've circled into this situation with integrative medicine, or in this integrative medicine world that you and I are in, which is that we must treat every person like an individual. How that impacts a more public health standpoint, and you were an epidemiology major and so, or master's. And so I'd love for you to speak to that too, of when you get into these conversations with people who are like, well, what about herd immunity? What about public health? How do we manage these ideas together?
That's the best question. I mean, it really is. It's really tough because there is no answer. You know, some people call it like the social contract. And I did get into that a little bit because it's a hard question. I mean, there's not an easy answer to that. I think when you talk about something like Hep B, that's where I think medicine's losing people, because you're pushing something for public health that has a very, very, very low benefit and a very low likelihood of benefiting that child versus some potential risk. You're giving a newborn baby a vaccine. Now we're talking about giving multiple vaccines to a newborn, vitamin K, Hep B, and RSV. You can get all those in the first couple of days. And that is very scary for a new parent who just had a baby to give it to them. And then medicine's like, no, that's fine. It's not going to cause any issues. And you're like, but the baby's like a day old and you're giving them a vaccine. So that is creating hesitancy. And I think to give a baby something, a newborn baby, you need to have the absolute highest bar for benefit and the absolute highest bar for safety testing. And the original Hep B studies were safety tested for just a couple of days, like 5 days. So it's pretty crazy. I mean, there are more studies that have been done after, but the bar to get that one approved for little kids is not, was not that high, in my opinion, compared to what it would need to be for that. And the reason why, in general, you really have to dig into it, it's because we want to decrease the rates of Hep B for everyone. You're trying to get to kids before they have a risk. Some people that have hepatitis B don't know they have hepatitis B, so potentially could give it to a kid. So it really does, if you look at the statistics, I mean, it has really worked. Hepatitis B has dropped to near zero. So it does really help kids overall, but the risk to your kids specifically, if you don't have hepatitis B and you've been tested and nobody around you has hepatitis B, is also very, very low. And so when you're talking about individualized medicine, that is something you could consider if you don't have any real risk to do it later. But that's where it comes back to this social contract, or what do we, you know, what do we owe other people? What is our moral take on vaccines and protecting other people? Because the thing that's always talked about in medicine is like, well, what about the kid that has cancer? Or what about the kid that has the autoimmune condition that can't get vaccines? Or what about the baby that can't get vaccines? And that's true. I mean, they're, for most of these vaccines, if everybody gets vaccinated, it does decrease the risk to other people, not for all of them, but for a good chunk of them, you can increase your herd immunity. So it's not as easy for the vaccine or the disease to spread. And so you are decreasing the risk for that other child. The reality of someone who's extremely immunocompromised is there are many, many infections out there, many, many viruses. And so just because you are protecting from one doesn't really protect that child all that much, but you do a little bit. So, you know, that it's like, do we increase the risk of measles for this one child or do we not? Like, that's a really hard question, right? I mean, I think obviously you want to protect kids if you can, but the other side of the morality and the difficulty with what's going on is the schedule is increasing. There are many, many vaccines. And at what point do you owe other children, other people, you as a parent, that you want to protect your child versus somebody else's child? And when you perceive there to be a serious risk to your child or a potential risk to your child, then what is your contract to other kids and other families to be part of getting this vaccine to protect somebody else when you don't feel like your kid has that risk and you don't want to give them the risk from the vaccine? That's a very difficult question because everybody would come down in that stance in a little bit of a different place. And even more so because what if, you know, you might say like, oh, well, you know, we should get the vaccines. These are proven. They're safe. They're effective. What about in the future when a new vaccine comes out and you don't feel like that one's very safe or something's going on, you're like, I really don't want to give this one new one to my kids. Like, you have to also think about that too, where it's like these, you know, like just like COVID vaccine, like what a lot of people don't want to give their kid the COVID vaccine. Like, look at the numbers. It's like 3%, 5%, very, very low percent at this point of individuals getting that booster. But if you were forced to do that for other people, 97% or so decided they don't want to give it to their kids. So what is the social contract there, right? It becomes more complicated as we get more and more vaccines and the perceived risk increases. And so that's where, like, it's a good question with no simple answer, but the actual answer to this question is we have to talk about it. That is the answer. Like, I don't know the answer, but smart people should be debating this on stage at Harvard or at Johns Hopkins and talking about pros and the cons on a big stage so everybody can watch it, and then we can have these discussions, because it's not simple. Like, does the child with cancer deserve to have an increased risk of getting measles? No. But does the family deserve to force their kid to take 6 vaccines on the first week of life? Like, you know, these are questions that are real. They're real, real questions that parents have, and I don't know the answer to them. So I think we have to have those discussions so people can formulate their opinion, as opposed to, like, you're crazy anti-vaxxer, you're not getting your kids vaccines and you're going to kill the other kid. And it's like, okay, but that's not true. Like, that's not what they're thinking. They're not, like, not thinking about other kids. They're thinking about their kid. And you're, you know, most parents, their kid comes first. That's what a good parent does. And you are considering other people, but you're considering both.
Yeah, this is why it's gray. Literally, like, that is exactly why it's gray. It will never be black or white. It literally will never be that way. And I think modern humans, we want things to be black and white. This is also why I love birth, because it's not something that's easy to control. And there's so much that we don't know about it. And it drives people nuts. But it's, like, so beautiful to me because of that aspect of it. Now, with vaccines, it's like you said, if there's a new one that comes out on the market and these people who had prior been very pro-vaccine, and but then now they make their different choice, is that going to have a big paradigm for shift for them to say, oh, now I'm in that situation where I'm starting to question this, or, you know, yeah, I'm going to think about my individual child's risk. And it's like, nobody has a crystal ball. We don't know. We don't know what's going to happen. We don't know who's going to get it and who isn't. And yes, do the kids that are immunocompromised deserve protection? They do, theoretically, but how do we do it? Like, of course they do deserve it, but first of all, vaccines are not 100% effective. That's another, like, thing that I think people just think that they are. There's every single child that gets this will not ever get it, or, you know, who receives a particular vaccine will never spread or mount symptoms. Some people just don't have the mounted reaction to the vaccines. Some people lose immunity quicker than other ones. Some people, you know, whatever. There's this individual variability. And yeah, I know we have some of the study sort of that can show that we have maybe titers or whatever later on, then we have some level of immunity. Obviously, natural immunity is a different thing. And the way in which a mucosal entry into the body is different from an injection into the muscle and all of these different things, right? But, like, I think that we have to remember some facts when we're having these conversations. And I would love to see a big discussion and debate on a stage like that, because I think it would be so validating for so many people, and it would bring us together, because it would show that we're not, like you just said, people who choose not to vaccinate are not going, well, screw your kid. I don't care. I don't care about anybody else. I'm just going to do whatever I want, and I'm going to benefit off of herd immunity and, like, whatever, but I'm not going to take the risk myself. That is not what's happening in their mind. They have, for whatever reason, some sort of maybe they have a family history of developmental regression after a vaccine. Maybe they have a high autoimmune. Maybe it's a religious thing. Who knows? There's lots of different things. And so we have to stop villainizing people's decisions and understanding that in the end, like you said, we all care about our children and we just want them to be safe and happy and healthy. And so we all really have that same shared goal. And this, like, all the political stuff of this conversation has just completely splintered us. And I think any of the voices that are being really, really extreme are just not helping. It's very sexy. It's very, like, you'll get a lot of, you know, hits and attention if you're super extreme. And it's just not what we need with this particularly. And it brings me to a question too that a mom asked on Instagram about this particular interview, was like, how not to be afraid? How does she not be afraid with her decision? And I don't know, you know, you may not have the answer to that, but I'm sure that you have to counsel parents all the time in your office. You know, to do it this way, to not do it that way. So how is it that you manage those conversations?
Yeah, I mean, the crystal ball is nice, right? Like if you had a crystal ball and you knew your kid was going to get measles and die, then you would get the measles shot, probably, you know, you run, go get it. If you knew your kid was going to get the flu shot and have a horrible reaction, you probably wouldn't. But we don't know that before. So you have to go based on what you know. And I think the way to be a little bit less worried as a parent is to really look at the risks based on what you see out in the world right now from vaccines and from the diseases. And most likely they're both fairly low, right? Like most of these diseases are not that common. They don't happen very often. Even if you do get it, you're most likely to be fine. Not everybody is for sure, but usually, you know, the risk is still fairly low. Like RSV, for example, when people get super scared about RSV, but sorry, but 90% of kids get RSV before they're two, and not 90% of kids are in the hospital. So most of these diseases, it's just if you get very unlucky or you're immune compromised or something like that, then it increases your risk. But the reality of the disease is we just don't see them that much anymore, thankfully. And we're stronger. We have better nutrition in general. We have better sanitation. So we're more able to fend these off in general. So I think that can be helpful to parents. And most kids get vaccines and most kids are fine, right? So I think that at the end of the day, the reactions are still pretty rare. In general, you know, I think the bigger questions around like some chronic disease stuff maybe still linger there, but just in general, in terms of like very serious reactions that happen right after a vaccine, that's still very, very rare. You know, it's not something I've ever seen personally. And so while I don't dismiss parents and their stories, because you can only hear the same story so many times before you're like, okay, there's something to it. And a parent who goes to get a vaccine is not anti-vaccine if they then have a story about why they don't want to get more vaccines because something happened to their child. You know, sometimes things happen and they're just correlated in time, but it's not because of it. But a parent who doesn't want to vaccinate their kid because they feel that their kid's been injured doesn't have any reason to lie. They're not anti-vaccine. They took their kid to get vaccines. So they're if anything, the opposite, but they just, something happened and they believe that. And maybe that story hasn't quite been told yet in the way that it is in the real world. But either way, the reality is most kids are getting these things and they're fine. So I think at the end of the day, your kid will be just fine, but that's not good enough for medicine and science. Like our job is to make the decisions to help these kids be the healthiest possible. And just like you said, we all agree our common ground is healthy kids, right? I don't care where you are, if you're pro-vax, anti-vax, in the middle somewhere, you want your kids to be healthy. Not everybody agrees on how to get there, but the way to go in that direction is to come together. And we can do that by not dismissing people, but by listening to them and saying, okay, well, here's your concerns. What do you feel like is missing in the research? How do we get that information to make you feel more comfortable? Because it may turn out in 20 years from now that vaccines have nothing to do with anything and they're the most amazing, best thing ever, and they never cause a problem. That's not true, right? But like, let's just say, right, it could be. And if you get the research that people want, it's going to make people do more vaccines. And that's what you want. You want them to anti-vaxxer to be quiet. You give them the research that they want. You don't tell them to shut up. Like you hear what they have to say and you prove it to them. And what has happened over the last 5 years or so is instead of discussion and debate and proving to people, censorship, no discussion. And so we don't have any debate and we don't have any, I guess, discussion around this. And so you're creating a bigger divide, and that's making people more fearful when it doesn't have to be that way. People are not just going to stop vaccinating because there are some theoretical concerns, but they will if we just keep saying, I think they're safe, they're effective, just do it, just keep doing it. Let's do 20, let's do 40, let's do 70. When is it going to be too many? You know, you're going to do 3,000 vaccines? Like at what point is it going to be too many? And you even read things like from the CDC website or Paul Offit that are like, well, you know, and I like Paul Offit. I mean, he's a really smart guy, but they talk about like, oh, you could do 10,000 vaccines in a day. That'd be fine. Like we're exposed to so many antigens. So your immune system could handle, but that's not a vaccine. It's not the same thing. Like, it's just not the same thing. It's a ridiculous thing to say. Yes, your body can handle a lot of antigens in the real world. That is true. We are exposed to things all the time. That is not the same thing as a synthetic product that you inject bypassing your natural immune systems. And it's also surrounded by a bunch of chemicals that are meant to enhance and have a reaction in your immune system, that's not the same thing. You can't have 1,000 shots of chemicals in your body and that's going to be just fine. It's a ridiculous statement. So I think there's a middle ground there. And until medicine acknowledges that there's some risks, that you can't just get 10,000 vaccines and it's not going to be a problem, then people are not going to trust it, because anybody with basic common sense knows that doesn't make sense.
Right. Yeah. No, I'm glad that you said that. Thank you. And I have a follow-up question to that. But first, I want to ask, so earlier you were saying, you know, parents need to look at the individual risks for their child and what's happening and the risks out there in the real world too. And our nutrition has gotten better, our sanitation has gotten better. But I know that somebody's going to be thinking, well, the risks are low because of vaccinations. So how do you then manage that?
Well, that's true, though. I mean, both those things are true. And staunch anti-vaxxers will say, oh, it's just because of the sanitation. Like, you look at the graphs and it's sanitation. That's what happened. And it's true. I mean, a lot of the decrease in the death from these diseases happened well before vaccines came around, because people were not as healthy 100 years ago, 200 years ago. So you would get sick with these things and you would die. That's what happened. But even before the vaccines came out, just in the year before, there were still hundreds of thousands of many of these diseases, or thousands of them. And the vaccines, you can look at the graphs and it goes, you know, from here, it just goes, well, you can see, but it goes straight down right after you get the vaccine. So both things are true. Both things helped. And the easiest example in our recent memory is chickenpox, right? It's really simple to just think back to chickenpox. When we were growing up, not that long ago, everybody had chickenpox, right? And it's not that it's was super deadly or everyone was super scared of it. Everybody had chickenpox parties. But because everybody got it, some kids still got sick. You got serious infections happen every so often. Kids would go to the hospital. You could get pneumonia. You could get meningitis. Like, things happen when you're talking about millions of kids. And so you see the vaccine come out and then basically goes down to zero, or very, you know, very low amounts of cases. So the vaccine plays a role in decreasing the transmission for most of these infections and decreases morbidity. Not so much mortality, because mortality has decreased significantly before them, but still it decreased mortality because measles, you know, 500 kids used to die from measles, now almost none, because we have the vaccine. So the hard part with public health is that's part of the decision-making, because if everybody decides they're not going to vaccinate, then measles is going to come back and then you will have a risk again. So you're weighing those two things, and they're both true, but that's where discussion again comes in, because there might be some vaccines that we could start decreasing. Maybe we can give some of them later. You know, there are things that we can start to do, and maybe we prioritize certain ones. Like, yeah, everyone's worried about measles, so maybe that's when you prioritize that and you make sure everybody gets their measles shot at whatever point. Or maybe there wouldn't be such a huge risk if everybody got their measles shot when they were 8 years old. I don't know. Like, there are different ways to do it, and not everybody does it the same in the world. So we just think like, oh, the CDC way is right. But you look at other countries and they do measles all sorts of different times. And maybe there are ways to decrease risk from the disease while also decreasing risk from the vaccines by pushing some things back or not do, I don't know. That's what exactly. Research is for.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's the point. It's like, I think that people in general want there to be that effort. I want to see that effort, that they are trying to figure out that ultimate Goldilocks perfect balance of risk benefit ratio for each individual vaccine as it is at all these different ages and different factors. And then also it still needs to be done all together too, and not forget the fact that we are, you know, a little 2-month-old baby, 4-month-old baby is going in and getting several at the same time. And what does that do to them? But I love that you brought up chickenpox too, because that's one to me that I feel like also contributes to the hesitancy because of its requirement now in California for schools, mm-hmm. when it's like something that when there's so many more on the list that are deadly, and chickenpox is very, very unlikely to be that. Yes, maybe when you're talking on the scale of millions, there's going to be the one meningitis case, or maybe for the child that has full body severe eczema needs to get the vaccine, because when they, if and when they get chickenpox, it could be a completely different thing. Now, but to require something like that, that seems like a pretty, and you know, I know our parents' generation feels that way about measles, and not the same thing. Chickenpox, measles, not the same thing. But this erosion of like the important, to me, I don't know, it erodes the importance of what vaccines could be, which is like, let's reduce chances of deadly illnesses. Like you're saying with Hib, so Haemophilus or pneumococcal, things that cause meningitis, obviously very, very scary, especially for little babies. Pertussis could be very scary for little babies. let's make these ones really good, really robust. Let's focus on these ones. And then maybe some of the others, we don't say, you must do that. You know, let's like have a shadow side where it's like, or like a next layer. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I like see
it. You mean recommendations? Yeah, like recommendations. That's it. To me, that's the way that we get to a better place, is just stop forcing people to do things. Start making recommendations. Start making recommendations based on risk versus benefits. Discuss them. Let people decide. And let people do what they're going to do. But many places in the world don't require vaccines. And it's not like most people are not getting vaccines. There are many states in America that don't require vaccines. And it's not like the vaccine rates are at like 5%. You know, most people are still getting it. So I don't think you need to require it. And I think that would make a lot of people feel more comfortable. They're not going to be forced to take something again that they don't want to do. And you combine that with doing research and moving towards some more understanding about these things. And I do think that would bring people together a little bit more. And that is a better path forward than creating an adversarial sort of, I don't know, position, because there might be a disease that pops up in 10 years or 5 years that's really, really, really deadly, and you do want a vaccine for it, and, you know, maybe Ebola comes all over the world or something like that, and you have a very high death rate, so maybe you want the Ebola vaccine. I don't know. But these are things that we can't just dismiss, because we just don't know where things are going. But it's almost like Boy Who Cried Wolf. We're like pushing every vaccine just because we can. And just because you can make a vaccine for something doesn't mean that you should or should be required. And we have to also get outside of our arrogance a little bit in America, because there are a lot of other countries that do different things and have fewer, but we have like the most pretty much of anywhere. And you look at the schedule past the 90s and it's like exploded right after the companies don't have immunity. And that's not an accident. Like, this didn't happen by accident. This is happening. And there's some good. We can protect from more things. That's not all bad. But we have to take notice of what's happening. And it is very clear that not just in America, all over the world. I'm from Toronto, and I was reading, you know, for the book, the stats there too. And it's the same thing. Like, the rates are plummeted compared to what they were 5 years ago.
The rates of what?
Vaccines, like just general vaccines, people getting vaccinated, people not fully vaccinated, these kinds of things. It's just plummeted all over the world. And that's not good either, because we will see a measles come back. Like, it's going to happen, you know, for sure. If people decide that they don't want to get any more vaccines or something else will happen. So I think it's a balance, and we have to decide where we stand. But until medicine acknowledges the reality of what's actually happening, people are going to trust nothing. And that's okay. Not unreasonable.
And yeah, thank you for that. And you, just for the people that don't know, you said it quickly about how the vaccine companies have immunity. Can you talk about that law when it was passed, what it provides for them?
Yeah, in 1986. So in the 80s, I would say the late 70s, 80s, there was increasing concerns about some of the vaccines that were on the market, especially the DTP vaccine, diphtheria, tetanus, pertussis. There were a lot of lawsuits from companies that were making the vaccines around, especially like neurologic conditions, seizures, encephalopathy, things of that nature. And when you're giving a perfectly healthy child a product and that child gets a serious reaction, in theory, from the vaccine, a lot of times it wasn't proven, but when you're suing about those kind of things, you win a lot of money if you win. So there were a lot of lawsuits. A lot of companies were very scared of all these lawsuits. They were losing a lot of money. And so a lot of vaccine companies left the market and just left only a few. And at that time, they decided that they would pass a law to give basically immunity. There are a few ways to get around it, but basically you can't sue the companies anymore for any reason other than the negligence. So they don't have immunity. They don't have any sort of risk from getting sued, really. In general, now if you get a reaction, you can sue the government if it's something that they deem as a causative reason from the vaccine. But you're just suing the government. It's just part of the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. And you have this Vaccine Injury Act, which basically gives immunity and no liability to these companies. And so after that happened, that did stabilize the market, of course. Like, that part was good, I guess, in terms of the fact that the companies would continue to make vaccines. But you now have a product that doesn't have the checks and balances that it really needs. And it's really the only one to have that, because really in a capitalist market, the big check and balance you have is getting sued for a product that's faulty. And you, if you don't have to worry about getting sued, you don't have to make them better. You don't even have to make them safe. You just have to make it seem like it's safe, get it on the market, and then, you know, you can't get sued. So even if it happens, like, you can pull it, I guess, if you can prove that it's unsafe, but that's usually a really hard thing to do. So we have this situation now that is problematic because these companies have immunity and they know it, and they don't have any good reason to make their products safer other than, you know, being good people, I guess, but their company, their job is to make money, not to make us healthier per se. So it's a problem, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for, you know, explaining that. It's a really unfortunate truth because they have no liability now for the products they make. And I think that the bigger issue, as you just said, is they have no incentive to make it better, which blows. Like, that sucks. That is
right.
We're not going to, like, guys, what do we think is happening here? There has to be a way that we are keeping this in check with all of the other businesses and companies out there with everything. If there is a problem with it, you will not make it. You will not survive because people will not take your product. They will sue you. You'll go under. You'll whatever it is. And these guys don't have to, they don't participate in that. It's very frustrating.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you just think about it and you're like, okay, if I'm a company and I'm making a product, let's say the MMR, why would I go study it more to find a problem? And why would I want to make another one? Because first, you're admitting that there's an inherent problem or risk, which why would you do that unless you're forced to? And two, you have to go spend the money to do the research. You have to spend the money to make the new product. You have to get, it's like, why would you spend all those billions of dollars when you don't have to? They have no incentive to make it better. And there's nobody watching over them to make it better. So that's where we are right now. Like, there is no watchdog. I mean, you have the FDA, but their job is to basically, like, you know, license it and like get it out there. But after that, unless a bunch of people complain about something and you can link it, which is really hard to do, then who is making them make it better? Like, this is something that we're injecting into our kids, many, many of these, and there's nobody making them make it better and make it safer, because right now we're saying, first of all, they have immunity, but second of all, we're just saying that they're perfectly safe. And that can't possibly be true. They're not perfectly safe. Nothing is. And unless we're studying these things in a way to look to make them the safest possible, then we're just going to keep the status quo and we're just going to keep adding more. And that's not a good system. And I think that's why people don't like it, because they're seeing that this system is so inherently flawed that, like, we're missing the checks and balances on pharma. They're bigger than government. They're bigger than anybody. They own practically the company, the groups that are monitoring them, like the CDC and the FDA. Like, they fund them a lot of what they do. So there isn't a great oversight over these companies. And so they have every incentive to make products and no incentive to keep them safe. And it doesn't mean they're making products to hurt people, but it just means they don't have incentive to do it. And we need to make that a reality. We have to make sure that these companies, they can make their billions. That's fine. Like, they make a lot of good products that can save people's lives, but they have to make their billions and also make safer products. And we have to make sure that happens.
Yes, I agree. I don't mind. I don't care. Make all the money you want, but make it because you've done a good job and you
make
are
us healthier.
Yes.
Make us healthier. Make it better. Make find things that cure things. Like, that's good. That, like, you can make your billions if you cure cancer. Like, great. But, like, you have to do that without causing more problems. You have to make sure that those medications, those products actually make us healthier. It's a net benefit. And we have to understand those side effects to have true informed consent. And we are, or have, entered a place over the last few decades more and more where that is not happening. That absolutely is not happening. They don't have anybody watching over them. There are no checks and balances. And if we want our kids to be healthier in the future, we cannot live in this pharmaceutical paradigm where they have no checks and balances, because they're just going to keep making products that are unsafe, or they're going to keep making products that are not as safe as they could be, because they don't have to. And we have to force them to make sure that they do. Our job is to have healthier kids and have the best products available. And that will only happen if we require it of them. I have no problem if they make their billions, but they need to make it by making the best products possible. And we need to make sure that they do that.
Agreed. And then, you know, start listening to the parents who do have those one-off stories where something is off, and take it seriously and take and show the respect to the people whose products they serve, that, like, there may be problems. And so it would behoove you to look into that, you know, like, why it just, it, I don't know. It's, I agree on everything. Okay. I have a few other questions that were asked on the Instagram polling for this particular interview. A lot of people wanted to know your thoughts on vitamin K.
So vitamin K is a very interesting vaccine. It's been used for a very long time. It's not a vaccine technically, it's an immunization, but it's categorized under vaccine because it's, you know, it's given the same way. But it is a vitamin. There are other things in there. So I think it's wrong for doctors to say, oh, it's just a vitamin. It's not. There are things in there. There's not a lot of other stuff in there, but there is a preservative in there and a few other chemicals. Vitamin K deficient bleeding is not a good thing. It's not extremely common, but it certainly used to happen. It doesn't really happen anymore because we do give the shot. It works quite well. You have about a 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 25,000 risk of having the bleeding, which if it happens for a baby can be quite bad, right? If you have a brain bleed, you don't usually notice it till it's pretty late, and that can be really bad. So that's why they invented the vitamin K shot, because you just don't have a lot of vitamin K when you're born, and that does decrease your risk. The oral vitamin K does work. It does help too. So, you know, if you're not going to do the shot, then I would still recommend the oral. But it just doesn't work as well as the vaccine. So it's not, again, it's not a huge risk, but it's just if it happens to your kid, it's a big deal. And that's why it was invented and it's been used for, I don't know, 70 years or so.
And then what would be the risks that parents are worried about the vitamin K? They don't want to take it.
I think the big risk is just giving your kid anything when they're first born. You know, things you hear would be that are they born wrong? They were born this way. It's natural. So we're giving them something that they were not supposed to have. There was a concern about leukemia at some point, and cancer risk, but that doesn't really seem to be a risk. That was just from a study or two. And really everything since then has not shown that. So I think those are the big, the other thing is the black box warning. There is a black box warning on it in terms of anaphylaxis and hypersensitivity, but realistically that's more for like IV drug administration. So it's not really in the form that you use for the vaccine. So the risk is not really there from what you'd be doing for kids. So I think it's really just like you're giving your kid anything. That's what parents are concerned with. But, you know, just because something is natural doesn't mean it's good. I mean, pneumonia is not good. We have antibiotics. So sometimes we have things that can decrease risks. And so that's what you got to weigh, because, you know, we don't know all the risks from the vitamin. Maybe the low vitamin K is there for a reason long term. I don't know. But we do know that vitamin K bleeding is real, and it basically is zero if you get the vitamin K shot. So that's something that you weigh. And I would say of all the things that are done in the first few months, vitamin K is probably the most common that people will do and not do the other ones.
Right. Seems like a pretty effective and lower risk side of things there. Okay. And then what about the combination shots? What do you think about spreading out, you know, when you could do more individual versus doing several different diseases in one shot? I know a lot of parents are worried about that one because it seems like it would be too much for the system, but then other people say no, because overall it's less antigen, just more at once. And
yeah, I haven't seen any noticeable difference in giving it. I think that if anything, the problem or the concern with vaccines would be the chemicals and the ingredients in there in general, and just the action of doing vaccines. So I think getting fewer tends to be easier for most kids. It doesn't mean you're getting like 10 pokes in one day, but your body dealing with a few things at once. Again, it goes back to how many things are too much. What can your body actually handle? We do handle a lot. So I think that, you know, four antigens, 10 antigens is not 10,000 antigens. So one versus four or whatever, it's not that much of a difference. So I'm not sure. I don't know if there's an increased risk. The research doesn't really show that there is. They've studied those vaccines against similar vaccines in some of the pre-licensure trials, and it seems like it's pretty similar safety and efficacy. So I think it's fairly similar, I would guess. I would think any risks would be the same, similar risk to doing one or multiple. I don't think that changes much. I think it's probably pretty equivalent.
Okay. And then, yeah, you just redrove at home. It would be really nice to have the inert placebo control trials so yeah, that we can compare.
I mean, exactly. Like that's where it's like you say that. It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, I know what the companies have said and what the inserts say. And, you know, they say, oh, well, we tested it against this and that. But I don't think that's the kind of testing we really, really need. We need some like external testing. And we need people to say like, okay, well, here is our schedule. Let's study combo shots versus not combo shots. Let's do this versus that. Like if you could do like in the next 10 years, like 1,000 different vaccine studies on all sorts of different things and different combinations, we could get a lot of information. And you might be like, oh, if you give the MMR shot with the DTaP, it increases your risk of seizures. Well, that's no good. Let's not do that, right? Let's give them on different days. Like, these are kind of things we could figure out. And there are a few studies that show some things like that, just very, very little. But yeah, these are good things to know. I don't know. I would want to know if you have an increased risk. Maybe you don't do these two vaccines on the same day. You know, we don't really talk about it. We just never, just like, oh, it's fine. Do whatever, whenever.
With like the live virus ones. Yeah, no, that's a great point. Okay, well, Dr. Joel, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us. We very highly look forward to your book. It's called Between a Shot and a Hard Place, Tackling Vaccine Questions with Balanced Data and Clarity. And it comes out on May 20th. So be on the lookout for that. And then your best place to find you is probably on Instagram, I would guess, yes?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram or X at Dr. Joel Gator, or you can go to the website, theshotbook.com, and that'll take you to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or, you know, wherever you want to get books from.
Awesome. And all of your information and links will be in the show notes as well for just easy clicking for the listeners. And I really appreciate the work they're doing. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you.
Kids get sick. It's natural and normal. And there are things we can do to support their immune systems naturally that help not only with symptoms, but the progression of the illness. I've made a course that highlights all of my top immune support remedies and home care methods to support your children, from newborns all the way through to big kids. I discuss herbs, homeopathics, nutraceutical supplements, targeted nutrients, using nature as medicine, hydrotherapy practices at home, and more. The Winter is Coming webinar is a natural cold and flu course for kiddos that you'll want to revisit again and again. Find the link in the show notes. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Healthy as a Mother podcast. In order for others to hear this information, please leave a review with Apple Podcasts, subscribe, and send to a friend who could benefit from this content. We're so excited to share more on becoming and being a mother next time.
And please remember that the ideas and views of this podcast are for informational purposes only and are not intended to serve as a substitute for medical care of any kind, including the diagnosis or treatment of any illness or disease. Consult with your provider before integrating this information into your own care plan. And remember, a healthier future starts now, and it starts with you.